Welcome to On the Brink Radio with Jeff Phillips Wefferson, coming at you from Hobart, Tasmania, here on the brink of Easter weekend. We've got the illustrious and highly illuminating Stuart the Effect Simonson back again with us, coming from Atlanta, Georgia. Stuart, how are you?
Jeff, I'm doing great. Glad to be online talking to you. Spring has sprung in Georgia.
Yes, are there bunny rabbits out laying eggs for the weekend?
Yes, preparing for the big weekend.
Yes. I wanted to express my gratitude because even though we don't communicate directly all that much, I think of you a lot because of different issues that I become aware of, or that I think about relating to the things that we've talked about before and the kind of work that you do. And whenever I talk with or attempt to talk with Terry Lilly in Hawaii, but I was concerned. I was worried about you because a few weeks or a couple of months ago, you sent me a message on Skype in response to something, and you said you were so busy that you were deeply embedded in the military-industrial complex. And I go like, oh my God, are we ever going to get you out? And I go like, I hope you haven't abandoned, you know, the sort of undercover work that has put you and I in touch with each other. But describe a little bit how you've been embedded in what you've been working on. I can never remember the name of your company. It's got a Wheeler in there somewhere, but it's got two or three names.
It's not important. It's not my company, so it's not important.
Well, but it's your employer.
You know, I think about you every day. I walk by your paint that's in my kitchen.
But man, I really cannot thank you enough. I cannot thank you enough. Well, you've got two.
Yeah, I've actually got two. The other one is in the other end of the TV row.
Yes. Yes. Well, hopefully you'll have a third soon.
Anybody listening to this, I highly recommend they buy one of your paintings.
Well, you're up for number three.
I think it's probably in my future.
Well, look, man, but tell us what you've been doing as your job.
I think I'm your sort of typical engineer. Went up, you know, through engineering school and have been employed in the military industrial complex for 33 years now, and doing a lot of technical work, mostly design of industrial plants and processes. So I probably have done more engineering projects than, you know, 80% of the people out there.
Yes.
But there's still, you know, it's been my career. Let me just put it that way.
Yes.
After doing it that long, you get, and I'm a project manager, but after doing it that long, I think everybody in their lives want to give back, right? I mean, I think for different people it happens at different times. So anyway, I decided I would take some of my spare time and do some research, try to solve problems, just get involved, right? Become active. I consider myself a closet activist.
Active in helping life instead of helping to destroy it.
Yeah, that's, you know, a lot of the whole corporate activities and existence goes against nature, right? We're consumers, where consumption is rising, and we destroy a lot of things just through business, right? So I just decided to take a more active role. You know, it feels good. I enjoy it.
Well, wouldn't you say that a lot of your engineering projects are involved with decreasing the impact of the industry in terms of its environmental context?
Yeah, actually, since the late 1990s, a lot of my work has been environmental remediation, you know, or remediation, just in existing production facilities, cleaning up the air and water emissions. So there are a lot of projects that, you know, have have improved the environment. So, but you know, everything you do, every industrial plant has an impact on the environment. Usually about many times it's detrimental. You try to minimize that impact, right? So that's a lot of what I do.
Yes. Well, may I ask you, what do you think about the whole 5G thing that's being rolled out?
So what I think is that there's nobody, I think they got the fox watching the hen house, right? I don't think there's anybody really in the government that, you know, they may throw out some regulations, but there's nobody policing it. There's nobody looking closely at, unless the people force them to, the state and local governments don't really want to get involved with it.
Yes.
So because of that, we're rolling out technology that we have no idea of what its impact could be.
Exactly, and we can't. We can't know.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I would just, this is one of the things I was going to ask you about. If you look at what we call mutation in terms of our understanding of the human genome, yes, our understanding of what we call mutation is very limited because there is a well-known person who I mention him quite often. I saw him in a brilliant documentary about Rachel Carson after she published Silent Spring in 1962 or 1963, and his name is Dr. Arnold Lehmann, L-E-H-M-A-N-N. He was a genetic toxicologist who was a colleague of Rachel Carson. He was talking about how in the wake of the new synthetic mutagens that came into being mainly after World War II, both radiological and chemical toxicity, like for example cesium-137, strontium-90, all your radiological nuclides, and then all the chemical mutagens, specifically the biggest one of Rachel Carson's day was DDT. But he was saying that if we really want to begin to understand how these substances are affecting us genetically, we have to study at least 25 generations of people to really see what it's doing. And we that are alive now are only the third generation to exist since this stuff came into being. So we're just the very tip of the beginning of the experiment. We may not have even have had time to even see what this stuff is going to do eventually. You know, so that's exactly what you're saying with the whole electromagnetic mutagen scenario is even newer, that hadn't really come on the radar in Rachel Carson's day, yet it's probably even greater in terms of its saturation of the immediate human environment.
Yeah, I agree with that, and I think the real problem is there are a very limited number of scientists researching the effects of it, and they're far outnumbered by the number of scientists working for big corporations that are making lots of money selling it.
Yes. Well, hopefully there may be a few more people like yourself that are on the payroll of the big guys, but who might be on the side doing some really cool sort of quasi undercover work.
Yeah, and I don't try to be undercover.
No, but you know what I mean.
I don't think I want anything different than many people, is to have a clean environment, a safe environment for their children to grow up in, right?
You want to have grandchildren with only one head.
Yeah, one, two eyes, all that. And heaven forbid, my kids are both healthy, but they grow up and have a child that's disabled because of some environmental influence that nobody knew about, or people made lots of money off and didn't tell people. So I think it's a lot like tobacco, back 50 years ago. you know, it's heavily sold and marketed, and it's the impact of it. It will be known, right? All truths will come to the surface sooner or later. So,
well,
I think it will be known, and people will, you know, look back at all the, you know, potential suffering that was caused by it. That's what I think. I mean, you know, and what I get fed up with is you go around, you take your kids to a beach and a coral reef now, and they're mostly diseased and dead up and down the U.S. coastlines.
Yes. Well, look, but let me just ask you this before we go to that. With tobacco, at least it's a plant, and it is possible to have certified organic tobacco, possibly that you even grew yourself. But do you think that we might have certified organic 5G that might be safe?
I don't think it ever will be. Number one, I don't think it's organic, right?
It was just a joke.
I think the big problem, and if you've read enough research on it, it's not that it's ionizing radiation, but it's oxidizing. It's causing a lot of electron exchange.
Yes. Well, may I ask you, I read that the 5G terahertz bandwidth actually it interacts specifically with the oxygen molecule. Can you tell us about that?
Well, I mean, oxidation is the most common reaction. You know, I talk about it a lot, is, you know, redox reactions, reduction and oxidation. So engineers, we know it as corrosion. Okay, we deal with just tremendous amounts of corrosion in industry, and biologists call it oxidative stress. Okay, so but the cause is the same. It's electron exchange, and when you send out, you know, high frequency radiation, you move a lot of electrons. And if you don't believe me, stick a fork in the microwave and let it touch the edge when you turn the microwave on, and you'll see all kinds of electrons. So, when radiation, electrons, and when electrons are exchanged, they trigger oxidation. And a mineral loses its electron, but it gets attacked by oxygen and free radicals. So, it's unhealthy. And the more you're immersed in this EMF pollution, the more you're subject to it.
Yes. So you said that when you go to the beach, you're seeing the reefs and everything looks like it's just corroding?
Yeah, I think it's oxidative stress. It's what a biologist would call oxidative stress. And what I mean is, I think we put, any kind of minerals pollution that we're putting into the water, or any shipping that's using any sort of metals or voltage that they're putting into the seawater, and electrical charge, that they're triggering accelerated oxidation. And it looks just like corrosion, right? The reef is banding, and it's these black rings are expanding. It looks just like metal corrosion. And that's because our coral reef is actually made of metal. I try to tell most people that, but the calcium structure and magnesium, those are metals. And they corrode very, they oxidize very easily. So what I'm trying to tell people is the coral's house is on fire. We're burning his house one electron at a time. That's what I believe it is. And it's causing oxidative stress on all the critters that live on the reef.
Would you say that's
what I think it is?
Yes, and this touches on what we've talked about before in previous interviews. Would you say that these conditions are concentrated around coastal areas and specifically in shipping lanes, sort of probability areas, but would it be out into the far ocean away from civilization as well?
So I think the further you get out, of course, the deeper the ocean. Of course, the coral reefs are all in shallow water, right? They're all mostly near the near coastal in the shallows. So they're going to be in the most oxygenated water, and they're going to be the most susceptible to oxidative stress. So unfortunately, you know, that's where most of our good population, and of course the shipping lanes. But so I think that's the commonality. And then if you've got waterways that are emptying in, and like if there's mining going on and they're putting a bunch of minerals into the water, it will definitely kill a reef. I mean, there's good research papers on, you know, iron from either a sunken ship or iron dust in the air from the jet streams killing a reef.
Well, that's very interesting.
It's all oxidative stress, basically.
That's very interesting, because you've probably heard of some of these projects. I think, I don't know how many of them actually have happened, but even going back, I believe, to the 1950s, there was people that wanted to dump large amounts of iron filings into the ocean. And I don't know exactly...
Terrible idea.
It sounded up there with me of Edward Teller wanted to use nuclear explosions to blast out a new harbor in Alaska.
Yeah. Stupid.
Well, yes, to put it mildly.
Stupidity. How about that?
Yes. Well, look, did you see the article, the link I sent to you last week about the... They were talking about unusual lightning discharges happening over shipping lanes.
In the upper atmosphere?
No, down at the surface.
Okay.
Well, maybe I didn't actually read it.
No, so I have this slightly other model, NOAA. So I think our atmosphere gives off electrical charge all the time, right? We call it the weather, we call it storms. But I think we've missed where that, you know, standard weather meteorology tells you that's coming from hot and cold, right, in our atmosphere.
Yes, and pressure differentials.
And climate change will make it worse. So I don't think it's got mostly anything to do with that. I think there's another actor there that they've completely missed, and that's what my weather model is on my blog. And you guys, I hear Terry and some of these talking about chemtrails and all that. I don't buy into most of that. I do buy into the pollution from military jets and commercial jetliners. That's real. Okay, and they do leave vapor trails, and there is NOx and, you know, combustion products in there. So it is polluting. But, you know, I think, and I told you this before, I have this atmospheric weather model based on inflation. That our atmosphere is actually sort of blowing up like a balloon. It's inflating.
You mean physically?
The electric charge and the energy comes from.
You mean
it's
increasing
model of weather.
Increasing in size?
Yeah, no, think of a gas expanding. What I'm saying is that the that space-time, which is, you know how they say there's an unstable atmosphere when a storm is coming? And all I'm saying is I think that's an unstable space-time. I think there's inflation occurring, and entropy is increasing. So basically what's happening is the entropy of the gas in our atmosphere is increasing all the time. You know what entropy is?
Yes.
Yeah, it's the randomness. So when they say time follows the path of increasing entropy, right? So I'm saying when a storm comes through, there's all of a sudden a big increase in entropy, and that's why houses get knocked over and trees. Is entropy increases really very quickly. I'm saying our storms are caused by an entropy increase. Sudden.
Well, how does that
think about that?
How does that relate to electromagnetism?
Well, I'm saying that entropy, as our atmosphere is inflating, it can have electrical charge. It can generate electrical charge right from space. In other words, it isn't friction of water molecules or friction of dust. It's actually the electric charge is coming out of space-time. That's my motto.
Yes, but doesn't all of electromagnetism come out of space-time?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, that's where the photons and the radiation came from originally, right? Came out of space-time as it expanded.
Okay.
So all I'm saying is the vacuum is inflating.
Okay.
Our weather is triggered by vacuum inflation.
All right. Well, so...
to me, it's a great theory, but...
But let me ask you, it sounds like that this model that you're describing would describe the behavior or function patterns of weather processes on the Earth before humans even existed. And so given that, how would it have changed or be changing in accordance with all the sort of artificial electromagnetic technologies that we're currently operating in, our whole artificial environments, the electrical grid, and all this stuff?
Yeah. So I think there's a lot more energy bottled up in nature than humans are putting up. In other words, I think I'm not a big believer in climate change due to just human CO2. And I'm not denying we're generating some CO2, but CO2 is a trace gas. It's like 400 parts per million.
Exactly. And you said before in the Carboniferous era, it's believed that we had 9,000 parts per million of carbon, and everything was thriving, and we didn't burn up. We did not burn up.
That's right. So I don't believe climate change. It may even increase species or it's going to change species a little bit. You know, there'll be warmer areas and the water levels may rise, but I don't think that's an immediate danger to humans. I think humans are the immediate danger to humans, right? So I think nature has a lot more energy bottled up that it releases at times than humans will generate. They say that, like, I got some post on my blog, the Moore, Oklahoma City tornado, it lasted about 30 minutes and released 100 Hiroshima bombs worth of energy. One tornado.
Yes, and what units?
Inert nitrogen, the air, which is mostly inert nitrogen, and 20% oxygen was able to generate 100 Hiroshima bombs of energy.
Yes.
I don't believe that.
What units of energy would you use to describe that? Joules?
Well, it's megatons, but I mean,
of
energy
what?
Can be expressed in joules, BTUs, but I'm just saying the scale of energy that nature releases is much more than humans are currently generating, even if we blast off some Hiroshima bombs. So we don't give nature enough respect.
Well, but what you're talking about is precisely the central tenet of geophysical warfare. Like Gordon MacDonald wrote about how the key to manipulating weather and tectonic processes and stuff is to tap into and to trigger the release of these exact massive stored potential energy reservoirs that you're talking about.
Yeah. And I don't think humans, I haven't seen a lot of evidence that they are able to, put a laser up in the atmosphere and trigger a little rain. But, they're not able to trigger a hurricane or stop a hurricane in its tracks, right? So... are we close? I personally don't think so. I think, in my opinion, physicists are still looking for 95% of the energy in the universe, right? They haven't found it yet. So there's still a lot of hunting to do. And, I don't think humans really understand nature. And maybe we weren't meant to. Maybe we can't be trusted to. Because we're doing such a poor job with everything else. don't know. I just, as I get older, I get a little jaded.
Well,
I think we don't have a good understanding of climate and weather. And, you know, they can hardly predict the weather a week away.
Right? Well, now, let me ask you this. Dr. Nick Begich in Alaska made the point that at a fundamental level, all chemical reactions are essentially electrical reactions. And it makes sense if you look at, you know, the electrons and the bonding and stuff like that. So given that, would you say that it's possible that technologies or technological approaches might exist that could mimic or simulate chemical reactions through electronic or electrical means?
So for sure you can trigger chemical reactions using electricity, right? Electrochemical, a battery works off electrochemistry, right? So you absolutely can trigger chemical reactions through electrical discharge and all that. I don't know if that's what you're asking, but they work together.
Yes.
And they can work positively or negatively, right? So, you know, I try to make it simple, you know, for me to understand. And so, yeah, you can boil a lot down to follow the electrons, right? An electron, the interesting thing, if you study them enough, they're not really... we're sort of taught growing up that electrons run along a wire, inside the wire, along. But that's not really true. Electrons set up a field, and they take all paths in that field, right? That's quantum field theory. It says that there's elementary particles. They're really particles of a field, and meaning you might find that electron anywhere in that field, and that field might stretch out to the moon, right? So that electron takes all those paths and he creates a field. So just like when you put up a radar station or a high gain antenna, it generates an electromagnetic field and fills up the whole space, right? It's just like when you turn on a flashlight in a dark room, it lights up the whole room, right? With radiation. It happens to be visible radiation, but it lights up it.
Is this what you...
Photons of light are everywhere in the room.
Is this what you is this called scattering?
Yeah, well, it's just wave propagation, right? And it's been taught that photons of light or electrons, they take all the paths.
But this is
it. Of a field.
But if they're coherent though, they don't do that, right?
Well, they're the same wavelength, right? So you can. Depending on what your oscillation and frequency is, there's different frequencies of those photons in the field. So now, the higher the frequency, you know, you start getting to visible and then ionizing radiation, which is unhealthy. It starts damaging your DNA, right? So my point is that we're immersing ourselves in this radiation, whether it's an electric field or electromagnetic, and it's much, much denser than nature normally puts us under, right? In a very weak magnetic field, normally.
Yes, because life has evolved in the presence of low levels of all that stuff.
But now we just turn the volume up 100,000%.
Across the whole spectrum.
Yeah, and what I think, and if you read a lot, it triggers oxidation, which engineers know as corrosion, biologists know it as oxidative stress, and it starts showing up in your trees and your reefs and probably your children, right?
Could corrosion be happening inside our brains, inside our neurons?
Yeah, absolutely. It's oxidative stress. I mean, a doctor or biologist won't call it corrosion. They'll call it oxidative stress.
Well, how will that manifest physically or organically?
Well, it's probably the same way. You know, what happens is your minerals start getting attacked by these reactive oxygen species. You know, your minerals lose electrons, so now any oxygen in your bloodstream starts attacking the bones or starts attacking the cells because they're losing electrons. And a lot of your voltage channels in the cells are calcium-based voltage channels. They're very sensitive to electrical potential, right?
Yes.
So if you start screwing with that, you're going to get adverse effects.
Well, but would stuff start to crystallize in us that should not be crystals?
Yeah, or dissolve, right?
Huh.
Like calcium, if it loses electrons, it gets attacked by oxygen, and it will. And if you're in water, it'll make calcium hydroxide, and it will dissolve into the water.
Yes.
And it'll give off heat too.
Well,
oxidation reactions are exothermic, so they generate quite a bit of heat.
This touches on another big thing I wanted to ask you. Thermodynamically, tell us exactly what is heat.
What is the what? Say it again.
What is heat? What does that mean?
It's really a measurement of radiation, right? It's thermal radiation of the particles. It's a gas or whatever, but it's just a measurement of radiation in the end.
Does it have anything to do with the motion of the molecules?
Yeah, so it's the motion of the particles.
Well,
it's the vibrational energy, and it's, you know, low frequency thermal radiation.
Yes. Well, what I wanted to ask is, can you describe the difference between the heating that we feel from sunlight versus the heating that we feel from microwaves?
So I heard the first part, heating from sunlight versus
the heating from microwaves or radar.
Well, I mean, it's all photon radiation, okay? I mean, sunlight is visible radiation in a certain wavelength and frequency. So, and then microwaves and radio waves are a little bit lower on that scale, but they penetrate further into you, right? They're actually longer wavelength, so they penetrate more deeply than solar radiation. Now, there's a component of visible radiation that's also ultraviolet, right? And the ultraviolet can be damaging to your cells. So there's a whole spectrum of radiation. It's really just different frequencies. And, you know, depending on the frequency, it may penetrate, pass through you. A lot of the energy may pass through you or get absorbed in you. Does that make sense?
Yes. Because in my mind, I've sort of mentioned before that one of the things I try to do is to create maps or quantitative analyses of, for example, the total amount of microwave energy that humanity is pumping out at any given time, or the total amount of radiological nuclides that exist. And, you know, it's an impossible task, and I'm not sure that enough zeros exist in order to do it. But if you look, for example, at how much, like you've started kind of doing this with some of your maps of, for example, the amount of microwave transmitters in Hollywood.
Yeah. And, you know, all I did there, and that was my first research, and it actually got quite a bit of attention. And there was an autism study done by Columbia University. I overlaid Google Earth, and then I downloaded 12,000 antennas from the FCC database. I wrote a Python code that put it into Google Earth, you know, and mapped it. And I found that there's an extremely high correlation. The autism cluster which has 400% more higher rate of autism, and it's northern Los Angeles, and so it has 400% more kids with autism, and I measured, and it has over 450% more microwave broadcast antennas than any place in California or the country. So it's, that's a spatial correlation, right? And it's pretty strong. And then I downloaded the FCC spreadsheets on calculating the safe distance around the antennas. And one of those antenna farms has 20 or so high gain satellite broadcast antennas. It says the safe distance is 5 miles or so around that. And it's right in the middle of the autism cluster. So I think they fucked up, and I don't think anybody's policing it or watching it. And I don't think anybody looked at it until I mapped it. And I put it out there. And yes, it's got a lot of attention. I got an email from a university professor just a few weeks ago. Now, is anybody doing anything about it? I've lost, they raise money, right? They have fundraisers for autism. They spend money studying its effects, but, how many people are really out there looking for what's causing it, right? I don't think they want to know. I don't think industry wants to know. I think they would rather just give money to the cause than finding out they may be partially responsible for it. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I do a lot of mapping. I've done a lot of programming, so I can handle data sets pretty well. It was similar to the reefs. I had downloaded, I had a good idea where most of the military installation, Terry Lilly, Terry, he's a little kooky at times, but Terry is brilliant in what he does, right? He dives every day, he takes fantastic videos, he loves the ocean and the marine life, and he wants to protect it, right? And kudos to Terry.
Absolutely.
He sees what's happening. Not sure just what's causing it, but he puts it out there for other people to see.
Yes.
That's great.
I think he would like it if he never had to deal with people.
Most of the, I don't say most, but some of the other researchers, they go out in the water once a year, right? They get out a couple times, so they're not in the water like Terry, surveying the reefs and the coastline.
Well, if you see a recent photo of him, he's...
That's how I got involved, and then I really started looking at the photographs and the maps, and have come up with my own opinions.
Terry has gill slits on his neck now.
Data. Say that again, Jeff.
Terry has gill slits on his neck.
Yes, he does. He does.
Well, look, I've asked you this before, and it's an impossible request, but could you sit down and create a set of calculations that would be a rough estimate of the total amount of microwaves that are being transmitted by humanity at any given instant?
Could I? Probably not, Jeff.
Why not?
I could take a certain area and extrapolate it. Because, you have to know every cell tower.
Exactly.
Cell
but
towers.
Antennas. It would be hard
Wi-Fi.
To... For the Western countries, that information would probably be available, but not so much for the... For countries like Russia and China, you'd have to make a broad, educated guess. But if you looked at the amount per capita, and sort of extrapolated, but could you do that?
I'm sure I could. Do I have enough time or want to spend the time doing it? I don't know. If it's a billion gigawatts versus $2 billion, is it really going to make a difference?
Well, yes. I think people are impressed by big numbers. The more numbers you can hand out, the more authoritative we're going to seem. And people are going to go like, look, these dudes are experts, regardless of even if they don't admit it, they're experts because, look, they've got these figures with all those zeros. And that means a lot.
Yeah. I have a lot of theories, but I got a scientist over in Spain. He emailed me, he says, hey, I'm writing a research paper, and I really like your theory and your research on dark matter and all that. But the paper, which I've got it linked on my academia site, it's about, you know, search for extraterrestrial intelligence in the universe. And how come we can't find it, right? And so the theory, and he talks about it in the paper, is, you know, maybe we've got the wrong assumption. Maybe we're assuming that intelligent species are going to fill the universe with radiation, you know, with radiation. And maybe they're smarter than that, right? Maybe they already know that it causes cancer and causes autism, right? Maybe they're way beyond that.
Of course they know this.
They're not using radio waves.
Of course they don't.
Because they're unhealthy.
What you're saying right now is exactly what I told people like Carl Sagan and Frank Drake and all the SETI astronomers back in the 1990s when I visited them because of my dolphin research. I go like, look. And then even, do you know who Freeman Dyson is?
I sent you a link to that research paper. You should read it.
Well, yeah, but hold on. Freeman Dyson said, he made the point that if we're looking for microwave transmissions, which is what the SETI thing is all about, radio and microwaves, we're not looking for the life forms themselves. We're looking for artifacts of their technology. And I've told these people from the beginning that we're surrounded by life on this planet that, you know, we don't know where we came from, and we're in space. And I truly think that, you know, even given the total anthropocentric notions of intelligence and all this stuff, I fully agree with what you're saying, that any truly advanced beings are not going to be sending out microwaves and radiation and stuff like that. And Carl Sagan even said in his book Contact that the true sign of the most advanced intelligence would be that they leave no trace or footprint whatsoever. So I think that there's wavelengths of interstellar communication or information transfer that water-based life uses, and we're enmeshed in this network all the time, only we just have absolutely no understanding of what it is. But the whales and dolphins and the indigenous people, especially of Australia, they do know this, and that's a big part of what I'm all about.
Yeah, and we're basically using military technology to communicate, right? We're using radiation to communicate, and it's radiation in a spectrum range that is damaging to humans, but we've decided to use it for all our communications and entertainment.
You know who probably the most important mind behind all that was Tesla.
I think it's great ideas. I mean, these are all ideas that someone tried out and said, hey, we can broadcast radiation copious amounts and detect it thousands of miles away. Wow, let's use it to communicate. Well, sounds good. It's a good idea until you understand that, you know, maybe not given kids autism within 5 square miles around it. That's my take on it. Just not. And then there's nobody really policing it or watching it. Why am I sitting at home on my laptop computer plotting some spatial maps? Why do I come across that? Why is it critical to the researchers? You know, part of it is this country, you know, we're more, spend most of our time with entertainment and sports than we do science, right? You know, Carl Sagan, said this earlier, but we're surrounded by all this technology, and most of us know nothing about technology.
Absolutely. Yes, the amount of people with their telephones in their hand on the street is actually very scary. Well, hey, but look, tell me more about the extraterrestrial intelligence thing. So you wrote a paper about that.
So I sent you the article, okay? It's actually, it was in a science journal a few months ago. And I'll mention, I got an honorable at the end. But I helped review the paper, communicated back and forth. So I just sent you a link to it. But it just talks about that our, it's the gorilla in the room, right? There's a video on YouTube where, you focus on people passing a ball back and forth in a room, and it says count how many times the ball goes back and forth, or how many times someone with a white shirt catches it. Meanwhile, a gorilla walks through the center of the room, and if you're focused on the ball, nobody sees it, right? So nobody sees the gorilla because they're all focused on the wrong thing. All might.
Absolutely.
It talks about SETI a little bit. That, we may be focused on the wrong thing, which is what you were saying, right?
Well, we're not looking at life on Mother Earth.
We're looking for traces of radiation that probably damages life.
Well, and not only that, the SETI people were obsessed with, they think that we're the only intelligent species, and that maybe some other species might have a little bit, and that, but they're blind to the intelligence of biological life, of which we're a tiny part, thinking that they're going to detect it through somebody using microwaves on a different star system. It's a bit delusional. It's a bit delusional. Meanwhile, we're doing our best to wage war on life on this planet. And there's some people have an idea that this solid state electronic intelligence has a mind of its own and its own agenda. Now, what do you think about that for some conspiracy science fiction theory?
I think the problem with it is it has no mind. In other words, it just doesn't have a mind. So you've got technology, if it's programmed incorrectly or programmed, as a virus or a deviant, sort of purpose, then it absolutely can destroy humans. It already does, right? This program's Boeing jets, and they took, 300 people out of the air just because of this program. So my point is, though, that, these are machines that are programmed, but they have no sense of humanity. Does that make sense? So it's not that right now I'm worried about them getting a mind of their own. It's that they have no mind, and it's really a programmer or somebody who's put their mind into them, and they have the mind of a 3-year-old.
Yes, well, but exactly.
They think quickly, but they still have a mind of a 3-year-old, but they think quickly.
Yes, but they have no choice but to follow their programming. But remember, in the movie 2001, Hal the computer did not malfunction. He was following his programming, which was to eliminate the human crew.
Yeah.
Because the mission was too important to be left to human error.
Well, those Boeing jets were following a program that says, hey, you're stalling, nose down, when in fact they had just taken off and it was trying to gain speed and altitude. But the program was saying, you're stalling, put the nose down. So it did, it crashed them right into the ground. So that's my point, is that machines have no mind, but they're programmed. Have the mind of a 1-year-old. They think quickly. They can process a lot of information, but they still have they have the decision making of a 1-year-old if they're programmed incorrectly.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Yes. Well, now let me ask you this: What is your perspective on the universe if we looked out at radio wavelengths rather than optical?
Right, radio waves, pulsars, and all that. So I think it's a natural part of the spectrum. But there's a certain level which is harmful. Does that answer your question?
Yes, but I guess what I was asking is, how different does the universe look at radio wavelengths rather than at optical?
I'm sure it looks quite a bit different. I don't know that I've really looked at a radio spectrum across the universe, so I can't answer that.
Well, I guess what I'm getting at is that we're talking about different frequencies. And so do you think that it might be possible that there's even, for example, a galaxy that the whole structure of the galaxy is at a significantly different frequency domain than us? And so it may have the appearance of physical matter to itself, but to us, it would almost be virtual. Or, I mean, do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, and I think you're right. I mean, objects like pulsars and all that, there's different densities of the radiation, right? There's different power densities and it's all across the spectrum. So certain areas aren't going to be amenable to our type of life. Now, some other type of life might be able to survive there. But so yeah, I don't think anything. I think the universe leaves a lot of room for variation, right?
Yes. Well, do you remember an old science fiction TV series called The Outer Limits?
Outer Limits? I think I remember it, but I don't remember the show. I don't remember watching it.
Well, I'll send you a link to watch the very first episode, because it's a scientist at a radio station who is using the antenna, the transmitter, to tune into a microwave being in the Andromeda Galaxy.
Okay.
And it's quite good.
Yeah, I see that. It came out in what year? 1963-5. So I was born in 1964. It's right in my age range. I was a little bit young.
Yes. I've been telling people that they ask me where I'm from, and I say I'm from the Andromeda Galaxy. And I go like, yeah, we learned English from all the all your TV shows that came through.
Yes.
But that's not right.
Watch a lot of Star Trek.
Yeah, but that couldn't be right, because Andromeda is 1.2 million light years, and so Gilligan's Island wouldn't have got there yet. But look, let's draw this to a close. I think we're losing our connection, and we've covered a lot of the high spots. But do you have a brief summation or a message for humanity that you'd like to leave us with?
So I think it's the same thing I said last time. Wake up. Take action. You know, life's short. Don't be afraid to put it out there. We're all in this together. We'll all go down together.
We're all sharing equally of the same mutagens.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, look, this is On the Brink Radio signing off with Stuart the Effect Simonson. Man, thank you so much for your time. And think about that total quantitative thing for, you know, like just a big, big estimate, even in like exajoules of how much microwave energy we're heating and how much of it, you know, what the distribution of microwaves is in the atmosphere and the stratosphere. Like, for example, microwaves being transmitted to and from satellites and that kind of thing.
Right.
There's a lot of it.
Oh, there's a lot of it. You know, a lot of it You have to broadcast it up from the ground to get to the satellite.
Yes.
So those are the transmitters I'm concerned about.
Yes. And they would create a certain amount of heating in the air as they went through, wouldn't they?
Yeah. They create a radiation field right around the antenna. And if you put 20 or 30 of them in the same place, that's a lot of radiation.
And a lot of heat.
And heat, yeah.
Exothermic.
I just sent you the link.
Okay. Right on. Well, look, this is Jeff Wefferson signing off for On the Brink Radio with Stuart Simonson. Thank you so much, man, and I'll talk with you soon.
Okay. Thanks, Jeff.